Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, a trustee of the Royal Academy of Arts, and very proud to be so. Welcome to our podcast.
My name is Kate Goodwin, and I'm the Head of Architecture and Heinz Curator here at the Royal Academy. And it's lovely to be hosting this evening's event and the exhibition upstairs in partnership with the Architecture Foundation. And it does mark the opening of the exhibition Shared Cities, which is the 2014 prize for European public space, which has been organised by the CCCB in Barcelona with support from the cultural programme of the European Union. And when Ellis first came to us about this project, it was something that the Architecture Foundation had been involved in for some time. But I think when Ellis first came looking for a venue in London, we felt it was really important to be able to show and discuss public space here, and particularly at the Royal Academy. It's been an ongoing theme, I think, that's kind of echoed throughout the programme of what we've done, looking at understanding that architecture always needs to be part of a wider conversation and its integration into the cities through public space. And, you know, there's been a number of projects. I think we've looked, I don't know if people are aware, the Reimagining Mayfair project, which looked at this immediate vicinity here. The Academy is linking this building here, Burlington Gardens, with Burlington House, and suddenly opening two entrances, and the Academy has started to look north to this environment. You know, what happens here in Mayfair? What, how can we make this urban realm more engaging, more interesting, to give a little bit more back to the street? When we had the proposal to design, we had an invited competition using ceramics, or trying to come up with a ceramic installation. And the proposition we chose was the one by SO, Architecture and Ideas, which might be, you may have seen as you came outside. But part of the reason we found it such a compelling proposal was that it activated a space on the corner of a street that was long lost. There was a big barricade around it. No one actually used this space, and it became quite an important thing, I think, for us to take that barrier down and to change how it was used. And I think that those kind of threads are sort of there for us, but I think the projects upstairs make some really quite exciting and profound positions about public space, and it's great to be talking about Raynham, the One London project here. So I'm going to hand over to Ellis Woodman, who's the director of the Architecture Foundation, and who's going to chair this evening and introduce the speakers.
Thank you, Kate. That's fantastic. The way we're going to work it this evening is we're going to have about an hour and 15 minutes down here, and then proceed upstairs to the official opening of the exhibition. But for those of you who haven't seen the exhibition yet, really the kind of the hook for tonight's event was that Peter Beard's project for Raynham Marsh is, as Kate says, the one kind of British project that features among the finalists in the European Urban Public Space Awards from last year. And so we thought tonight was a great opportunity to talk about that project, but also a number of other schemes which have been delivered by different architects as part of a really coordinated initiative driven by the Greater London Authority and the London Borough of Havering over the last decade. For those of you who haven't been to Raynham, we're talking about somewhere that's right out on the very edge of London, kind of in Essex, you travel by about 20 minutes train journey kind of east from Fenchurch Street. And this is an extraordinary landscape that you you kind of come out at, where there's a very extensive marsh, which has now been transformed into a nature reserve by the RSPB. And then the medieval village of Raynham alongside. And these two very remarkable entities in their own right were kind of severed from one another by the Channel Tunnel rail link. And the task of reconnecting those and making a new route from the Raynham village to the Thames is really the kind of one of the defining themes of that connects the different projects that we're going to look at tonight. So if those of you who are Architects Journal readers, you will find this current issue is devoted to the kind of sum up of the whole kind of range of individual projects that have taken place in Raynham and the past decade. We've only got time for a small number of them this evening. But the way we're going to try and work the structure of the presentations is really geographically, that we're going to start with Peter describing his work at the Marsh, and then move over the Channel Tunnel rail link to McCrennel Avington's new library and housing scheme, which Prisca Thielman from McCrenna Levington is going to talk about. And then further into, across the village, kind of to the north, and from where Dan Jones of Civic Architects has realised an extension to the Royals Youth Centre. And then finally, we're going to have Levant Kerimal from the Greater London Authority, who's going to talk about, in rather more cosmic terms, about this really remarkable initiative. Peter, would you kick off, please?
Okay, so a primer on the marshes. The journey travelling east along the Thames from central London passes through a landscape of relict marshes, chalk and gravel quarries, and major industry, overlaid with elements of large-scale infrastructure, trunk roads, electrical pylons, commuter and high-speed rail lines. Rainham's marshes lie on the north bank, flanking the river along a 4-kilometre stretch. Historically, the marshes formed part of the river's floodplain, a geography that's still evident in the alignments of transport infrastructure and patterns of built settlement. Rainham Village is set back from the river on a rise in the land at the floodplain's edge. At 600 hectares, Rainham Marsh is around 3 times the combined area of Hyde Park and Kensington Gardens, and twice that of Hampstead Heath. The marshes are home to a wide range of breeding birds and are a nationally important habitat for the European water vole, Arvicola amphibious, together with rare wetland plants and invertebrates. Up until the 1970s, Rainham Creek was tidal. Boats carrying freight would dock at the wharves near the centre of the village. Freight included timber, coal and building stone, as well as produce from local market gardens bound for central London. Through the 20th century, the marshes were used by the War Office, later the Ministry of Defence, as a training ground and rifle range. Throughout this time, the land was still grazed with herds of up to 1,000 sheep. Military use protected the marshes from encroachment by other forms of development. Loose patterns of drainage ditches mark areas of historic grazing marsh, with some of the alignments dating back to medieval times. Between the areas of grazing marsh are silt lagoons made up of dredged material from the Thames, forming a raised plateau supporting saltwater habitats. In 2003, Landrun were commissioned, together with the German practice Latzen Partner, to develop a master plan for the marshes. The plan looked for conservation and habitat enhancement, including better water management, the reintroduction of grazing, public access, and small-scale built development centered on education and environmental play. The principles of the master plan have since been taken forward with the adoption of an incremental approach. Early projects included the boardwalks on the Purfleet Nature Reserve, which belongs to the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, giving public access to wet woodlands and relict grazing marsh. These boardwalks offered local people their first formal access to the marshes in over 100 years. At the western end of the marshes, more boardwalks make a public route through partially existing reed beds. Sections of open water have been extended in the form of new wetland scrapes. In terms of their quality and placement, these boardwalks can be understood together with the highway structures of the A13 as parts of a common infrastructural language. The same timber piling used for the eastern boardwalks forms the foundations for a group of public and educational buildings on the Purfleet Nature Reserve. The new structures have been integrated with areas of open water, reed beds, and screening banks. A 90-metre-long boardwalk gives access to the main building cluster via a cut in a newly formed earth bank. Open decks give access to the individual buildings. 3 discrete building volumes make up a loose courtyard over the water. Part of the cluster is for general public access, consisting of a large open deck and outlook room. The remainder is reserved for school groups, with a small classroom opening onto a large outdoor teaching area. The main public deck is surrounded by a lightweight timber screen. This allows views out to the open marsh while screening wildlife from human disturbance. The building shells are formed from reclaimed international shipping containers sandblasted to remove all original paint finishes and reveal the weathering steel beneath. The public outlook room is formed from two containers placed side by side. From inside the room, there is no clear registration of the two volumes of the prepared containers. The timber column you see here is structural, untreated larch, still with the bark on. A 9 meter long fixed glazed opening faces out towards the marsh. A lookout point on one of the new public paths lies 10 meters above the natural marsh level on an outcrop of ash and building rubble shipped from central London in the 1930s. The two benches share a similar construction. Both combine folded sheet steel with reclaimed oak timbers. The paving is made from reclaimed concrete rail sleepers. Together, these elements can be read as carpet, chair, and table, rendered in a raw and monumental tectonic language. Another similar setting can be found on the Western Marshes, on part of the site used as a construction compound for High Speed 1, the rail line used by Eurostar. Natural England recommended that the hardcore base of the temporary compound was left to develop as a brownfield habitat. Overlaid on this is a new paving layer of reclaimed concrete railway sleepers, colonized with self-seeding vegetation. Two benches in Portland stone, each the size of a double bed, have been laid onto this hybrid ground, a quiet sign of a new human presence in the landscape. Wayfinding signage for the marshes was designed in collaboration with the graphic designer's studio, Frith, who developed a new bespoke typeface. We also collaborated with Studio Frith on the design of a series of yard markers in Portland stone, which register the locations of firing banks from the time that the site was used for rifle training. This one marks a point 600 yards from the original target station. Bridges form an important element in the new marsh landscape as part of the 9 kilometres of new public access paths which have been established since 2004. An initial suite of 6 bridges used weathering steel to create fine frame-like structures that have a visual transparency both in elevation and in plan. The longest of the steel bridges crosses a new watercourse which acts as a buffer between a new foot and cycle access path and adjacent grazing marsh habitats. Each new bridge overshoots the water by a couple of meters each side, allowing for habitat links between adjacent sections of the new banks. A second suite of concrete bridges was installed along secondary public access routes. The concrete bridge decks are finished using the same compacted fill as the approach paths, in contrast to the visually transparent deck of the steel bridges. Self-seeded vegetation is allowed to grow over to form a mossy grass path managed by the traffic of visitors. The trackway is the biggest of the new bridges at Raynham. It re-establishes the historic link between Raynham Village and the marshes, first disrupted by the construction of the Fenchurch to Southend commuter line in the 19th century. The main bridge spans 120 metres with an earthwork approach ramp 80 metres long. We designed it in collaboration with Jane Winnick Associates, structural engineers. The construction of the trackway uses timber columns in combination with a composite steel and concrete deck. The bridge is supported on a total of 44 columns, crossing 2 watercourses and a road to land visitors directly on the edge of the marsh. There are still future opportunities to extend the wetland under the trackway and to close this tarmac road and downgrade it to something more like an agricultural track. So this piece of land is immediately next to Raynham Village. So that's, I hope, 10 minutes. I wanted to finish with a brief comment on the relation of the marshes projects to the broader urban strategy for Raynham Village and the riverside. This is a strategy drawing that we prepared as part of our own work, which predates at least 2 or more of the projects that you're going to see this evening. So it's dated March 2009. However, it does establish the main principles which link design thinking for the open land of the marshes with the emerging structure of the new village core and proposals for Ferry Lane and the Thames Path. So while the marsh projects might be seen as quite particular in the way in which they address aspects of a rural landscape with a kind of base, minimal architecture, but it's worth pointing out that they've always been understood as part of this bigger, inclusive picture. Thank you.
Good evening. McQuaid and Laving were commissioned to do a library and a traffic interchange just on the other side of the railway line of the wonderful, big, expansive project that we've just seen. And this is quite a while back. I believe it was 2007-8. So a lot of things have changed there since. What I think has just become very clear, seeing the marshes are part of the green belt formed around London, and Raynham sits right on the boundary to the green belt. So we see it just on the right-hand side, on the edge there. And I think this is one thing to keep in mind for Raynham that's quite special about it, is that it is in this boundary location. We've seen this picture just before. Basically, the creek up to Raynham gives reason for why a medieval village was founded there, and also why it has a couple of kind of architectural gems, one being St. Helens and St. Giles Church, which forms the kind of center of the little medieval village, as well as Raynham Hall, which was owned by a trains person. It's the access to the village that made it happen. So there's both of these important buildings, but they're huddled together very close to the creek in this very tiny village, which is around a kind of medieval Y junction of roads. I realize I have to probably walk up to point them out there. In its edited form, it highlights the core of what is Raynham Village, and on the other side of the railway line, the big expanse of the marshes and the kind of world of industrial sheds which exist there as well. This becomes ever so more obvious when you look at an aerial photograph, because it's hard to pick out really where the village is, because the area, I guess, has somewhat been blighted by big infrastructure and big buildings over the years. So there's now a huge Tesco with its big, big car park to the side of it. The world of sheds and so on. However, I think people, I'm sure Lev will talk about this, but at Design for London have found that this village is an important place that could do with some support to survive the kind of incremental, or rather than incremental, big kind of sudden change around it, so that in the future, when the Thames Gateway gets developed with more and more housing, that Raynham Village stays a place that people might be able to identify with, because it is a place that has grown historically. So our brief for the library and interchange, I think, has four aims. One is to, and this is again the core of the medieval village here, one is to free the center from its bus stand. I don't know, can you see that there? Yeah. So all the buses used to stand right in the middle of the village and making it impossible to have any quality public realm. Another aim was to move the little 1960s library, which is right opposite Raynham Hall, to this new site, and to, by doing that, make way for, I guess, architecture that is felt to be more in keeping with the medieval village, possibly. And also to develop a site which is right next to the station, which at that point was a derelict piece of land, overgrown, and basically kind of in the way to make it possible to see the way into the village from the station. So this is just highlighting the relationship of Raynham Hall to the 1960s library to the right. So that is going to move, and right along straight is the site where the library has been built. And this, the kind of bus stand, which was very unsightly and was not making the best use of the center of the village. And this is the view towards Raynham Village when you come out of the, when you used to come out of the station. So it was difficult to find your way back into the village. And then the fourth objective, I guess, was to provide an arrival point if you came to Raynham on a kind of day out. So you might come to visit Raynham Hall and go on a wonderful walk through the marshes, along the river, and all the way to Purfleet. So this drawing we did when the idea of the big bridge was really only an idea, and nobody knew whether it was going to happen. It's now there. And at the time, the colourful shed by Alison Brooks had a big sign on it saying wild space. That was never put in place quite like this, but it was the colourful building now. So this is highlighting our site just next to the station. It lies at a crossing point of four very different environments. The medieval village on the one hand, the kind of Victorian extension to the village on the other, the big sheds to the south, and the large expanse of the marshes with its also the big electricity pylons. So a kind of meeting point of very different scales. It was included in the conservation area, even though it sits right next to the big infrastructure pieces. But that was very strategically, I think, to control what was going in such close proximity to Raynham Hall, which is a National Trust-owned property. So the placing of the scheme includes not only a library, but also an interchange, which brings all the buses from the center of the village closer to the station, as well as a new public green space. And we worked with East Architects on this. And so our building had to be placed in a way that it was creating a new space, this interchange, and the program of the building. Here it sits in the East master plan by East Architects, who were not only responsible for the public space around our building, but also for the public realm in the whole of the village, and I'm sure Lev will say a little bit more about this. But this highlighted the kind of Y junction, and at the same time, it's kind of little fingers kind of coming off it. Our building, you can just see the footprint of it there. I'm realizing that I'm missing a pointer. Maybe I can use this here. I hope you can see the arrow. So it has a very specific shape. It sits to one side of the site so that there's an alignment from the station into the village. Then it has a kind of cut end to it, which looks into, the center of the village, which kind of gives a face that looks into the village, which you will see in its three-dimensional form in a minute. And then it closes off this kind of gap that existed in the continuation of the road going around the corner and puts a kind of facade along that and creates more of a traditional road space on this side, while it creates a space on the a new kind of room, landscape room on the western side. The program for the building is a library, community rooms, a kind of creche, but also residential units. The project was commissioned by London Thames Gateway Development Corporation and Havering, and London Thames Gateway Development Corporation, one of their aims was also to provide the missing housing. And I guess it was partly funding the library, but also it was one of the aims was to provide the housing. So, but that was always seen as a bit of a difficult element by the Raynham community. But so it includes housing on this end and the interchange here. As a reference point, because we felt it sits on the edge of this village where everything is about 2 to 3 stories, but our brief was something somewhat bigger. We were wondering what kind of nature might this building have, and our reference is the idea that it might be a little bit like a large mill building that you get on the edge of a village next to a train station or a kind of waterway. So the organization of the building is such that you have the library and a cafe and shop at the arrival space off from the train station and the residential above that, with the larger building, I'm going to explain that in the next one. So there's a two-story element to this, which looks back into the historical village, and a larger building, 4 stories of residential, looking into the marshes, and all of us kind of embracing the new green space. The roof form is such that it gives, that is a straight north-south angled roof, which allows north light, but also photovoltaics on southern facing edges. But because of the irregular shape of the building, the pitches are kind of cut in an uneven way, which means that you get slightly wonky gables on the different sides, which take reference to the small medieval cottages that you find in the village. This is how it is there today, embracing the new green space, bus interchange on this side, and the larger residential part overlooking the marshes. From Raynham Village, you now see this face looking back into, and the bit of the building that kind of closes the road that goes around the curve. It's basically kind of forming a marker looking into the marshes when you see it from the south. It's kind of setting a marker for Raynham. The building combines red bricks and green glazed bricks around ground floor, taking references to industrial buildings. And there's canopies picking up the green to the library and for the bus station. So now there's an open route from the train station into the village. As you can see here, people arriving, big number of community rooms for partying.
This, some of you might recognise, is the plan that appeared in the AJ this week. I thought it might be useful just to point out some of the things that you've been hearing about. So number 18 down on the bottom here is the Alison Brooks sheds, which got reclad. Number 17 is Peter Beard's bridge coming from the marshes towards the bottom. Coming over to number 15, which you've just seen. Number 13, which is Raynham Hall. And B marked there, which you'll notice now is at the Y junction, is the Norman Church, and number 12 is the War Memorial, and that space around it, which was reclaimed from the bus station that Prisca was just talking about, which has now been paved by East with a couple of benches there. Number 7 and 6, you can see bookending that space, are sign frontages, shop frontages, which I'll show you in a moment, and those have been carried out in collaboration between Pi Architects and designed by good people who did the graphics for the frontages there. Number 10 is a 17th century merchant's house, and number 5 and number 4 and down to number 2 is the thoroughfare that I'm going to be talking a bit about, which East have made beautifully down to Railing Hall and a little pocket park space at number 3. Number 1 is the building called the Royals Youth Centre, which we've done a rooftop extension to. So this is one of the famous and much tweeted shop fronts for the most extraordinary place I've ever been. And if any of you are going to Rainham, or even if you have been to Rainham and haven't been into this shop, you really need to get back there and go in there. So Rainham's amazing reptile emporium, it certainly is, and it's an interesting sign which has been made, as I said, by designed by good people. Directly on the opposite side of the road of the Phoenix Pub, perhaps you're starting to recognise these. The white building just beyond the Phoenix Pub is the old library Prisca was talking about. We're now looking back towards the Y Junction with the War Memorial, Rainham Hall on the right-hand side, where you can see the red brick and beyond. Wonderful, trying to establish a continuity of hand-painted signs for these buildings. This one disproves that. This one is an image. I rather like the lady in the right-hand side of the window. There's something puckish and enjoyable about these shop fronts, which enlivens and also recalls, I think, some of the enjoyment of the original town centre. Looking back towards the Norman Church, this is the end of East's thoroughfare. You can spot those East followers among you. We'll spot those bollards a mile off. This is, you may have seen them in orange other times. Anyway, this mural here, I think is by Objectif, another small firm I don't know very much about, but I think this mural was proposed by, designed by good people and produced by Objectif. Lev, you might say a bit about what this project was, but it's entitled Walk into History. And it reminds me always of the Smithsons' Walks in Bath, a publication which they made, and this idea of getting to know a place geographically through a publication. But in this case, of course, maintaining that hand-painted vocabulary and using the village itself as the publication, I guess. So you'll just see Kings on the left there and the mural obliquely and the thoroughfare which leads down to the Royals. You can see beyond the Royals the struggling to describe it, Tesco's. That's a clock on that cupola there. So we're going to walk down this thoroughfare, which is made in wonderful clay sets and engineering brick walls to left and right, and then some handsome pyramid stone copings, which you can just see in the forefront there. And the Royals is a rooftop extension, as I've said, for about 350 grand. And in some ways for me, it's like a timber wildlife hide or a treehouse, which has been blown up in a tempest and has embedded itself quite rudely into the roof of the otherwise terrible Royals building, which is only 15 years old and is a dreadful kind of Essex vernacular pastiche, which doesn't even serve the purpose it was designed for just 15 years ago. This is looking back down Julian's thoroughfare there, seeing on the left the beginnings of Mark Pimlott's Railing Hall and the pocket park that East made in collaboration with that project. This park is also getting layers of other projects on top of it by What If Projects. I think Gareth may be here this evening. So this, I think, is a slightly different interpretation from what the park was originally cast as, but has now taken these fruit trees, creating an orchard. So this is what we started with, and you can see the sleepers and the hand of East in that interesting line between concrete and tarmac there. We've made this rooftop extension. This is a more recent shot with some of What If Projects' planting going in there. And we've sought to make a connection using some of the vertical rhythm that's established by Railing Hall, but also which is established by the turret of the Norman church, to try to bring into a single entity, if you like, a kind of rooftop world. And so the sign on the top of the Royals building there is very much like the finials, the fleur-de-lis finials on the tops of these railings, or like the weather vane on the top of the church. And our building, of course, is rather rudely overhanging that thoroughfare. Getting involved in a major circulation route between Tesco and the medieval centre. We spoke to children and young people who use the building, and one of the things that they were particularly interested in was seeing from up here and also being seen. So this is rather bravely south-facing glazing with lots of cross ventilation. And in some ways attempts to carry the characterful and expressive and exuberant personalities of the children and young people who we spoke to. The ceiling obviously is seen very prominently from the street, and like some of Peter Beard's projects on the marshes, we've left raw as construction timber, which is completely unfinished. So there's an asymmetrical economy about the way in which this building has been produced. It's milled cedar, which is stained on the outside in two different colours. The fins, in some way, are like guardians of the space below. And the building is in, the top floor is in two halves. You'll recognise the non-orthogonal geometry of the space at the front, which is on the right-hand side of the picture. The left-hand side is a very much more straightforward and standard, almost domestic loft conversion, with a kitchen in purple and a wheelchair accessible loo, and we extended the lift to go up. So this is a view back towards the river valley, which overlooks the Tesco's car park. You can see the raw roof there. And the purpose of this space is to train school leavers to engage the employment market, looking back towards some of the more modern housing in Raynham. And this, the domestic space at the rear, simple and north-facing and less dynamic than the front, almost like two hemispheres. So I leave you with this, which I think is a really interesting tableau of elements, all of which are brought together in this rich mix. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Levant Karamol. I work at the GLA. I think I'm going to leave this picture up because it's quite useful, I suppose, for some of the things I'm going to say. I wanted to say a couple of words picking up on the title of the Asia article this week, so Raynham, a coordinated change. And it's quite a compliment to think that there is some sort of sense of strategy going on across a large urban area controlling that urban change. Perhaps it's true, perhaps somewhere in Raynham that has sort of happened and there is some coordination. I mean, it would be easy to pretend that the GLA is somehow an all-powerful hand making all of these things happen and deciding, and you know, in at some points in the past in Design for London's history, there were people who criticised perhaps that there was this single organisation that had all of this power. But I would say the reality is probably a lot more complicated than that. And there are kind of many organisations involved, and when you work in the public sector, you realise there's infinite number of acronyms and alphabet soups of kind of different organisations that all have to work in partnership with each other, and then the individuals within those organisations that kind of have to make decisions, and there's no even clear sense that a single person, let's say the mayor or the councillor or whatever, is even in power, or what, where power lies is quite diffuse. Sometimes it sort of occupies various offices, different departments, and all of these things are somehow in this constant tension. And really the job is to try and navigate and negotiate your way through this complex web, and, you know, what, trying to work out and make a judgment of what you can actually influence, what's happening from somewhere where you weren't expecting it to happen, what you might have some sense of control over, where you might be able to find some funding and direct that funding in particular ways, and what you can influence through advice, gentle persuasion, sometimes slightly harder persuasion, getting different people involved and building alliances and collaborations. But I suppose the nature of that kind of quite messy process means nothing really turns out how you expect it to turn out. So it can be quite painful. I guess it's the same for many architects as well. You see, whenever you see these projects, you kind of see all the missed opportunities that could have been. So sometimes the ideas that were too difficult to achieve at the time, and you couldn't quite build enough of the collaboration that needed to all the collaborations to align to make something happen, as might have been a perhaps more ideal situation. So whether that be kind of on the architectural level of, oh, it would have been nice if we had a bit more budget to finish this off properly, that everything feels slightly unfinished, but also on the urban scale, you notice there's whole suites that of kind of projects and lists of projects that haven't been presented today that have never really been achieved, and maybe one day they will. So it feels like the whole Raynham project is only halfway there. There's lots of unfinished bits. And then equally, there's bits that, I mean, we didn't really talk about the Stephen Taylor architects did a master plan for the village itself, and also for some of the other brownfield sites along the A1306 corridor. And that had a very different idea for what the library site should or could be. And in reality, the kind of land ownerships and what the London Thames Gateway Development Corporation was prepared to purchase at the time or not purchase led to certain responses. And I think the response that's been led, that's kind of come out from McCrane Lavington in that case, has been a really good response to a certain set of constraints at the time. But it's always kind of thinking about, if there was a bigger plan, maybe things could have been different. It is funny to think that in, so as someone quite wise said some time ago, Mark Brearley, in the control room, the pilots have no maps. There is really no kind of sense of planning, if planning even exists, that there might be a strategy or a coordination around all of this. I mean, we do plans, and we get involved in plans and creating strategies, but really it seems that every plan only lasts a couple of years and it has to be reconsidered. And probably plans are more useful for the process and getting people around the table and building those collaborations, rather than the actual master plan or document or whatever that's produced at the end. And if there is anything that might be kind of coordinated or a strategy, then I suppose it's perhaps there isn't a kind of big collective idea that everyone buys into. Sometimes there's the word vision is used quite a lot in the public sector, but well, I would say definitely impossible that such a thing exists, because people don't stick to it, particularly in England, I guess. Maybe in other countries there's more of a kind of sense of planning, but there's no sense that people stick to an idea. I mean, perhaps that's a bit of a shame. But I would say what is important, and I think what's different about Raynham and maybe some of the other places that we've been involved compared to others, is, I suppose, the continuity of people. So it's particular individuals, both in the GLA or various different guises of that, and also in the borough, I would say. And it's individuals because, funnily enough, over the kind of period that's being described, the organizations have changed. There's a kind of constant restructuring. Certain individual, and then there's other kinds of individuals in the public sector who move around, who might stay in the job for 2 or 3 years, move on to the next thing in the career ladder, trying to get different positions. And within all of this change, you probably need a couple of people to stay the same. So the organizations being the Architecture and Urbanism Unit in the GLA, becoming Design for London, becoming absorbed into the London Development Agency, now the London Development Agency being dissolved, and then even in this period, the kind of the London Thames Gateway Development Corporation, which had a lot of the money for some of these projects, came into existence and went out of existence again. And that's all quite telling. And even, I suppose, the political will or the intention to see something through isn't necessarily always there. It feels like the whole idea of why people were interested in Rainham at all around the idea of the Thames Gateway seems to have shifted quite considerably, and it's somehow still, there's opportunities there, but the kind of funding isn't rolling in to quite the same extent as it once did. So it might be that it's the continuity of people, but I would say even more than that, it's probably a kind of a certain attitude that continues, and you might see that attitude within the people, and ideally you see it probably in Rainham between all the architects. And it's really interesting to see how all the different designers have kind of got certain things in common, certain it's this sort of sense towards the city and their role in making that change. And it's interesting how they've kind of played off each other and taken bits from each other, and the level of collaboration amongst the designers has been quite interesting. But also I think an attitude that's needed for, I guess, kind of spatially sensitive designer types within the public sector as well, that is needed and perhaps is more and more lost. I think there's a need for people who can understand the process of urban change and kind of make that in relationship to the nature of lived experience day to day. So that's all I've got to say, I think.
We've got about a quarter of an hour left, and we were going to show you the rough cut of the film that we've been making about Rainham. It's one of a series of films that the Architecture Foundation's making about different outer London locations. The first one about Walter's Way in Lewisham was kind of finished last month, but they'll be appearing on the Architecture Foundation website imminently. So yeah, it'd be great to hear, because I can see that there are lots of people in the audience who know this place kind of intimately and have worked there already. But I guess I'd like to pick up on this. I mean, what was very clear from what Lev was just saying, I think, was the system in England doesn't automatically have this sort of outcome. This is a rather exceptional situation. And I think it's, I kind of know that with a number of the projects that we've been looking at, there's been an enormous amount of personal investment on the part of the architects in terms of the time and a kind of sustained involvement with a project that isn't going to make them much money. How can we make this a more normal kind of situation? How can we kind of make this a kind of standard for what planning in these sorts of environments might be?
I think it's difficult to change very big structures, change legislation. Well, it's easy, I guess, if you're ripping stuff apart and getting rid of things. It's difficult to put things in place that are positive. I think it kind of does come down to the people at the end, and it's what I was suggesting at the end, I would say, about having design-minded people there in all sorts of different roles, I would say. And I think there's been, maybe there was a brief moment where that existed, and maybe I should be a bit more optimistic and hope that that will continue. And I mean, I'm still there. There's still a bit of a team within the GLA with a slightly changed focus, but hopefully bringing a certain attitude to things that I suppose looks
perhaps slightly beyond the numbers of things, whether that be in terms of time or budgets or just tries to get, or in terms of outputs and counting certain measures, but tries to get at the quality of a project and work out whether things are good or not in a kind of quite difficult to pin down way.
Peter, could I just ask you, I mean, this is a kind of environment that you've been looking at that's neither city or nature. It's something that's often, isn't really an environment that's sort of been seen in aesthetic terms kind of, you know, in the past. And you've very much tried to make an intervention which I think isn't bucolic and it isn't industrial either, but it's sort of kind of working between those kind of two ideas. Does that feel like a kind of, there's a conversation to have about a wider stretch of the periphery and how we might think of those environments as public spaces?
I've not really talked about this in a public forum before, and it's not something that you brought up in, you know, those meetings you have with the procurement guys. But my my family, sort of two generations back, come from Hornchurch, from Raynham and Dagenham, other places around there. They were involved in market gardening and in running dairies and things like this. So I do have a kind of particular passion about the place. And I suppose there was an interesting coincidence when, you know, the GLA started encouraging a whole group of people to focus attention on this place, and that I had a certain connection to it already. And I think, so partly my understanding of the place is through that, through a kind of personal history, and that through, over a relatively short period of one or two generations, that landscape has transformed from being overtly rural to being really, one might say, highly industrialized, at least in parts of it. And so I think that the history of a relatively short history of the place kind of embodies a plethora of readings. So that's part of it. I think the other tradition that I feel very strongly about is the European traditions of urban design and landscape, coming through practices like Latz & Partner and others, the work that was done in Spain about Terrain Vague, and about you know, work that was done through the 80s and 90s, very explicit discussion about these kinds of places. And so I feel that the work that I'm doing is sort of balanced between an awareness of these broader European traditions but the way that can be brought into a project through a sort of personal focus. So over the last 10 years, the practice has done virtually no projects further than 3 miles away from the center of Raynham Village. And that's something that we very deliberately did as a, you know, in terms of the way that we wanted to approach how we work. So we're kind of I should probably live in Raynham, but I don't. So I kind of think of my, you know, in one way, I sort of pretend to be a local architect. So I think that, yeah, that the kind of complexity. So I suppose within those European traditions that I mentioned, I think there's a lot of discussion about this hybrid condition between industry, the post-industrial, the post-military, and how that intersects with spaces of production or agriculture. Like, there's not necessarily a clear definition of the rural anymore in many kinds of spaces.
Do we have any questions from the audience?
It was only briefly touched on, but I wonder what the people of Raynham think of all of this. Nobody talked very much, I don't think, about consultation and public engagement, and obviously this kind of such a comprehensive project, I would imagine, has got a lot of opinions from people that you'd need to capture. Maybe you could say something a bit more about that.
I think the feedback I know of is quite a few years ago. I would actually be interested, so I'm probably interested to hear, because Dan's been involved with all this, but more recently I'd be very interested to hear what people have to say today. I think at the time when we started working on the project, not much had yet happened in Raynham, and people felt very much like Raynham had been a kind of forgotten patch, and they were keen for attention, but on the other hand, very, very worried about change. So it's not, which probably is not very, it's typical for anywhere. And yeah, very, not very specific there. But Raynham definitely has a community that is quite ingrained with the place, very settled. On the other hand, I guess it has all the people moving in, and that feels much more, in a negative way, kind of part of the kind of dormitory world. People coming, commuting back to London, and so on. So it's that mixture, and then people are attached to their car parking spaces, and so they kind of. I think it's important what Lev says, that it's somehow it all works with having the right kind of design-minded people in the places where buttons are pressed, because quite a lot is not really being perceived, I think, other than, ooh, now I can't go by car to my library anymore, because obviously today it's policy to have a library without car parking spaces. Sometimes the commentary you get doesn't go beyond that, which is a shame.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. We've done a lot of community consultation on other projects, and we certainly did try to do quite a bit on this project as well, and we achieved some of that. But when the client that you're working for is the user client, they are the direct recipients of the building. They're making decisions about what they want that building to be like based on their knowledge of running that building in the first place, because unlike Prisca's, it was a refurbishment. Then it doesn't feel quite so mechanical as it sometimes can, going outside and setting up a wallpaper pasting table and trying to snag people as they walk past. We didn't have to do too much of that. We did some of that. There were winter fairs in Raynham. But actually, it was a direct conversation with the Royals. And the planners were only delighted to have somebody do something with design ambition next to that massive Tesco's. So there wasn't the same difficulty that Studio Weave have had working alongside, or Macrona and Lavington have had working alongside Raynham Hall, which is listed. It really is the fringe of the city where it turns into a car park, so people weren't that bothered. It's quite interesting to note that when you're working in the field of community architecture and design, it's quite a rough and ready field, as Russell, I think you well know. For example, it wasn't entirely clear to the Royals, for whom we felt we were working, whether they actually owned the building or not, and it sort of didn't matter. So there's an awful lot which is left up in the air, and that's fine. There are other things that are more important. So I think the sometimes, as I said, slightly artificial feeling mechanisms of consulting with the community, which let's remember is not a consultable group. You have to identify specific groups of users, specific community groups who you then seek out and then pitch specific questions to. When you're working for people who are the users, they are the community. So it's quite straightforward, really.
If any of you haven't been to Raynham, do make the trip. But I'd like you to join me in thanking our speakers for tonight.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the Royal Academy, please visit www.royalacademy.org.uk.